All right, this week's Parsha is Parsha's Bo, and the title of the class is Parsha's Bo, When Howard Stern Went to Therapy. So let's go to the videotape. Here we go. Now do a share screen.
Personal evolution in recent years, sparked by some intensive therapy. What was the first thing that got you in?
I was going through a divorce. I'm the father to three daughters. I didn't know, I was scared out of my mind. I had been married most of my life. How am I going to have a successful relationship with any woman, or man for that matter, if I don't know what's up and what's down? And when I got into therapy, I had to start learning how to be a man. I didn't have any lessons. I didn't really have that level of communication with my own father.
So you're learning how to become a man. When does it start to become apparent in your interviews?
I had never really been alone in a room with a man where he heard me and listened to me. And I describe in the book that when the first session I went in, I'm sitting there and I'm telling him stories about my parents because I'd never been to a psychiatrist. I needed a psychiatrist. I have it all together. I sit down and I'm doing some of the best radio routines I've ever done. I'm doing impressions of my mother. I'm doing impressions of my father.
You're going to be the best patient.
The best patient because I got to be loved. And he turned to me and he goes, none of this is funny. And I was like, well, you know, hey, I do this for a living. And he goes, no. He goes, why don't you get real with me? Some of what you're telling me sounds very sad, and yet you're laughing at it. Well, this was mind-blowing to me. No one had ever said that to me, and I had never had a real conversation like that before. And as the years went by, I got more and more turned on by being listened to.
You're being heard, but you're also shining more of a light on the people you're talking to.
Going to SiriusXM and having 4 hours to do whatever I wanted and not have to worry about, you know, the size of the audience.
Forget about those three people not listening to you.
That's right. Just let go of that. And that's also something I had to work on in therapy. So when I'm sitting there, I said, what would it be like to really hear what someone has to say? And it has led to some incredible conversation.
It's great that he's gotten help and he's, you know, a softer, gentler Howard. Has he apologized, though, to some?
He says he has reached out to some, and he clearly says that he's embarrassed by a lot of the things he's done in the past, and he's stopped doing some, not all, some of the more outrageous things on camera. We have an extended cut of our conversation on Hulu. It's also going to air on ABC News Live online Thursday at 9 and 4 Eastern.
Whoa. All right. Okay. Stop share. Okay. All righty. All right, so I was apparent from the interview. Why did Howard Stern go to therapy?
Because, he was lost at when he was going through his divorce. He didn't really know who he was, you know, or how to be. You know, he was alone. I mean, not alone, alone, but... Like you said, he'd been married most of his life.
Right. In other words, basically, it was only when he was very scared because he had hit this massive personal crisis. His wife I think he got married when he was 20, very early. They're having a divorce. He now is responsible to co-parent three daughters. Interesting, fun fact, sidebar. His eldest daughter became a Balas Tshuva, by the way. Okay. His daughter, Emily, his oldest daughter, became a Shomer Shabbos. So, fun fact. And he's proud about it. He's about being who you want to be. So that
he's talked about that on the air, no? He made fun of himself, like how bad of a father he was if his daughter became... I think so.
So I haven't heard.
I don't doubt that.
Right, but he has been. So, but she claims that if you look on the, you'll Google it, she claims that he's been supportive about the fact that now she's committed to halachic lifestyle, and he's cool with that. But anyways, the key point is that he went to therapy because he was having a massive personal crisis. His marriage of many decades falling apart, and he realized that he did not know how to function. Which, of course, gets to the obvious question, which is, why did he not go to a therapist earlier? And
had to hit a bottom. He didn't know. Got to wake, need to wake
he up. Also had his life. He could talk to
him. All right, so number one is that, so Chaim's point is that
everything was a joke. It wasn't serious. It wasn't, like, considerate. So, like, that was his life. He was in his own world of cold, narcissistic, everything revolves around me. And I get paid for it. I'm wonderful.
Right. So he's a rock star. Everything he says, he does, is turns to gold. He's beloved. So he had no motivation to go to a therapist. He did not recognize until he hit the crisis of how bad shape he actually was. And this, by the way, is not uncommon. Okay?
Very common. Very, very common. I'll take personal. Oh, I realize you're on recording. I forgot.
I am recording this. So just guys, just note that. So fix my green screen over here. So this is classic, as Chaim pointed out. Many people live either they're oblivious to the problem and they think everything's great, and then it's only when they hit a profound challenge do they then have to go to a therapist, or they live lives of quiet desperation. They assume their life is to be miserable. Life is being miserable. Life is enduring the same problems week in and week out. And they don't ever reach out to get any expert help on this. This is not uncommon. Which, of course, begs the question, and I think everybody's dealt with family and friends with this, why do people not go to doctors or psychologists when they have real needs? This could be for physical needs. It could be for psychological needs. Why? I mean, this is a common thing. But why is this?
They're afraid to find out the truth.
Okay. So there's a fear of, in other words, I have this lump on my body. If I go to the, I don't want to even imagine the issue may be cancer, so therefore I will, if I don't go to the doctor, I don't have to confront it.
I would say it's possible.
I believe there are many answers here. So I think Marvin's point number one, there's a fear of recognizing how significant the issue may be. Number one, what else?
I would say there's a very big denial, like it's not that bad when it comes to me. So, right, that guy, he's the one who has such a problem. You see such a person like that, right? I don't have such a problem. So right. I might be, you know, XYZ, but it's not a problem that needs such a level of help.
Excellent point. So a person wants to believe about themselves that they're in control. They got the situation covered. Everything is fundamentally good. And they want to deny the, you know, psychologists, psychiatrists, and doctors, those are for other people, weaker people, people whose situation is not under control. I got everything under control over here. All right, it's not perfect, but I'm managing the situation. So they deny the extent of the problem, therefore they do not go. What other factors are there? What do you guys think?
I think kind of picking back on that, excuse me. I think there's a large element of shame, especially with psychiatric issues, but also physical issues as well. There could be a lot of shame built into that.
Excellent point. So we have fear, we have denial, and Arden bring up an excellent point, which is used specifically with psychologists. going to a psychologist or a psychiatrist is the issue of shame. If I'm going to a psychologist, I must be fundamentally lacking. I must be a crazy person. Only weird people, only dysfunctional people go. The reality is, a remarkably high percentage of people go to a therapist. And every time I speak to a student and they tell me that they're going to a therapist, I always congratulate them. That's fantastic, because that's a breakthrough, and you are taking your life seriously, and you want to grow, and that should be encouraged. And what Artem brought up is true. Many people do not want to get any kind of help, coaching, therapist, counselor, psychologist, social work, the whole gamut of anything to do with that, because they have a sense, a stubborn sense of their personal greatness, and that to admit that is shameful, and also to admit defeat. That I'm not the person I want to believe in myself. Okay?
Rabbi, can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Adrian.
So, two more points. One is, I think, just cost. Just practically speaking, psychology can be expensive. And two, I think, for religious Jews, they think, well, I'm getting all the therapy that I need from Rabbi Pinney and his Torah wisdom, which has some validity, but I think that can also detract from seeking professional mental therapy.
So, Adrian, I'm glad you brought that up. First of all, there is a factor. I think the price factor is to go to a high-quality therapist is probably could be $250 for a 45-minute hour in Manhattan, oftentimes not covered by insurance, okay? So that is not, I don't want to negate that, but there are options, and a person is committed, can get some help. And the truth is, here's an issue. Let's say a person needed money to have a lung operation. What would they do to get money and ask family and friends to borrow money for that? They would. So why is a person's psyche any less important than the person's lung? That's point number one. A person's health and mental well-being, whatever it may be, is absolutely critical. And if you had cancer, you would not, most people would, they would do what they could to get the best care. So why is a person's psyche any less important than their physical body? I think that's another misunderstanding. It's point number one. Point number two, when I'm counseling people, there's two levels of counseling you have. So what rabbis, certainly at MGE or synagogue, we do is there's a pastoral care. That's a first level, first responder level of counseling. In other words, dealing with issues, talking them out, working out good life strategies, etc. But all good rabbis, even if they are clinically, to go to engage in a psychological relationship is a counseling of a different order, which myself and others are not really equipped to do. What we do is we will then suggest to a person that your issue would probably be best dealt with under the care of a trained professional. And I've given referrals, dozens of referrals, over the years at MJE. So I view myself as sort of dealing with a certain level of life problems. We'll call that, that's what they call pastoral care. And then there is clinical therapeutic care, which is the next level up, which is a person you need to go to if a person has a particular issue, a trained professional. And you can't, and schmoozing with your friend, it has a value, that does not count. In fact, oftentimes people try to have, non-experts try to solve significant problems that's actually caused the problem. You know what I mean? Your best friend is well-meaning, but they're not trained to solve your problems. I'm not saying I don't want to negate the help that your friend could offer, but there's a limit. And they're also, by the way, they're not objective because they're your friend. And most friends, as we discussed on classes before, will oftentimes not be truthful to you because they do not want to disrupt their friendship with you. They don't want to say things, even if they know true things, they don't want to tell it to you. So that's not helpful. You know what I mean? So I'm not saying not to schmooze out your, I'm not going to negate the value of sharing your successes and your disappointments with your friends, and that's a good friend, but that's not a psychologist, okay? All right, and all, but I want to equal, I'm not talking about merely psychology, also physical things. People, how many people don't go to their yearly physical? How many people just, or simple, don't go to their dentist every 6 months? How many people don't do, over 50 going to, get a colonoscopy, don't do the basic things to ensure that they're a healthy person and to avoid things that they're, that could be, to avoid big problems, small problems becoming big problems. This is, especially those people who deal with parents or more older family members, this is a burden that adult children have, encouraging their parents to get the care that they need. Some people are like, I don't want to be a bother. That's another thing. We have the fear factor. We have the shame factor. We have the denial factor. I don't like to be a hassle. It's okay. You deal with that, and you have to deal with that. That's the situation. Has anybody had, before we go on to the next part of our shiur, has anybody had to deal with a relative and try to encourage them to get proper medical or psychological help? Raise your hand if you have had to deal with that. Okay, that's 3, 4. Okay, it's what's been some of the biggest challenges in dealing with that? I think it's helpful for people to hear. Brooke, let me hear from you.
I mean, all the things that the class have put out there are there, like the fear of facing the truth, the fear of what it might mean to hear the truth, the shame of kind of losing strength, whether mental or physical, and denial of the problem, all of those things.
So was there a particular strategy that made you successful?
Brute strength on my part of like calling and making appointments anyway and right, forcing them to show up.
Okay, there you go. All right. That's well played. Okay, so we are now going to, on that point, this introduction, we will circle back. Obviously, you may have been wondering, how am I going to weave in Howard Stern into Parsha's bow? But that's part of the whole shtick of the class. So I'm not telling you, but we're going to keep on going. Okay, so let's go to, so Parsha's bow has the last three plagues. Arba, Choshech, Makas Bechoros, Locust, a plague of darkness, and the plague of the firstborn. And all right, so I'm going to do two sections here. We're going to read first, going back, Hashem tells Moshe what's going to go down, the very specific request he's going to have them to do. So let me have, who would like to read? Any volunteers? All right, Marvin, go ahead.
Screen is not.
I have to share the screen. Correct. That's helpful. That would be pretty good. Okay. There we go. 319.
I know in advance the Egyptian king will not allow you to leave unless he is forced to do so. I will then display my power and demolish Egypt through all the miraculous deeds that I will perform in their land. Then Pharaoh will let you leave. I will give the people status among the Egyptians, and when you all finally leave, you will not go empty-handed. Every woman shall borrow articles of silver and gold, as well as clothing from her neighbor or from the woman living with her. You shall load this on your sons and your daughters, and thus you will drain Egypt of its wealth.
Okay, so Hashem tells Moshe what's going to go down, that at the last, before the Jewish people to leave, they are to literally borrow from the Egyptians all these articles of clothing, and gold, silver, and clothing. All right, so let's see what actually happens. Keep on going.
Yeah, could I just ask you a question there? It's using the term borrow, but
yes,
you're really not borrowing it. They ultimately use it for some not so good purposes, but those couple things there, I guess you'll talk about later.
Right. So there's a couple dimensions in order why it says Vaisha Alu, they borrowed the so there's a whole debate, and we actually discussed this a couple of years ago in this class, was is, you know, some according to some borrowing means here means can be used in the sense of a nice asking. Just an asking, you know, when a person says, can I borrow a cup of sugar? It's, you know, that's not, you know, it depends on the context. It could mean, you know, you're borrowing or I'm asking for a gift. Okay. So according to some, it was a gift. According to some, it was a borrowing. And of course, the question is, you know, they're not going to return it. So we dealt with that issue, a different class, but which is of course then at YU Torah. So we're going to take a different dimension from the same part of the story. All right, so now let's see what goes down. Go on.
The final plague. It was midnight. God killed every firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of the Pharaoh sitting on his throne to the firstborn of the prisoner in the dungeon, as well as every firstborn animal. The people took their dough before it could rise. Their leftover dough was wrapped in their robes and placed on their shoulders. The Israelites also did as Moses had said. They requested silver and gold articles and clothing from the Egyptians. Hashem gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so they would let them have what they asked. The Israelites thus drained Egypt of its wealth.
Okay. All right. So it, you know, so as promised, it occurred. All right. I just noticed I cut out five psukim there just to get just to the point that I want to talk about. Let's check out the Rashi's here. Rashi, they did accord with the Moshe. Go ahead and Marvin, finish up the text for tonight.
They did according to the word of Moshe, which he had spoken to them in Egypt. Exodus 11:12, and let every man ask his fellow.
All right. So first of all, so by the way, so this Rashi is making a big point that he's trying to, you know, is that remember they're now having to turn to the people that had enslaved them. Okay. This is not a small thing. You know, it's like a little bit of a huge chutzpah. They're going to turn to them and say, oh, by the way, can I have your, may I borrow your gold, your silver, and your fine clothes? Go on.
Vishmalot, is that?
Usmalot, which means and garments.
And garments. They were even more valued by them than the silver and the gold. The later a thing is mentioned in the next text, the more valued it is. Cf. Mechitla.
It's a mechilta to Rabbi Shmuel, right?
I.e., the fact that silver is mentioned before gold shows the text is mentioning the objects in the ascending scale of value, and consequently, the garments, as being mentioned last, must have had the most value. A little bit on my screen here, I'm missing by them.
All right, stop right there. So that's an interesting question. Let me just pause on this little point on the Rashi. Why do you think that to the Jewish people, asking for a nice Armani suit from their former enslaver was more valuable to them than gold and silver? Clearly, gold and silver, in an objective sense, is clearly more valuable. Why was getting nice clothing so important to the Jewish people? What do you guys say?
Did clothing denote status as slaves, like in any way? And would the nice clothing be a symbol of freedom?
Yes, because as people were slaves, they did not, obviously they didn't have the money to buy nice clothes. So to wear clothing of dignity, clothing of aristocracy, clothing of significance was something that they craved because it's something they never had before. Now obviously they certainly liked the gold and silver, but the clothing, which didn't, in other words, just to give you an example, I think a person has a house, you know, let's say you have a housekeeper. You might give them all kinds of gifts, but you're not going to allow them to wear your clothes. And why is that? Suzanne, what do you say, Suzanne? Why would a person not, you know, has a cleaning lady, you won't allow her to wear your best dress? Why not?
As a germ freak, that freaks me out a little bit because that's like a personal thing. That's to me, that's, well, to me, that's like very personal, but...
Right, so clothing is clothing is something which is very you select it yourself. It's your clothing is your identity. Fashion is your identity. It's part of who you are. It's part of who clothing is your. You could say it like this: clothing is your costume or uniform to denote who you want to present to your community. So that's something which is very intimate to you. So you're not gonna feel comfortable sharing it to that person, okay?
One of the men's clothiers has a slogan that sign like "clothing makes the man," or maybe that's
"clothing makes the man." Right, that's a famous statement. Yes, so that's that. So this is a big deal. So the Jews were very happy to get these clothing. All right, let's keep on going, Marvin. Let's read the last Rashi.
And they handed them over, even what they did not ask of them. Did they give to them? You say one, take two, but only go.
Right. So so not only did the Egyptians give them, but they were extremely generous. According to the Medrash, one dress, take two dress. One suit, take two suits. One golden candelabra, take two. Okay. And to the extent they basically emptied out Egypt of all their great wealth. Now, let's get into some of this. Let's break it down. Why did Hashem tell Moshe to have the Jews ask for gold and silver and clothing? What were they needed for?
To start off in their new life. But they had nothing, so now they'll have money.
This is a very good... Scott, you brought up a very excellent point. Did the Jews as slaves... Now, when we think of slaves, we automatically... project, let's call it the Afro-American slave experience in America, or we might think of Jews being slave laborers in the Third Reich. Did the Jews in Egypt, for example, did they allow them to have personal property? Here's a Chumash question, general question: Did the Egyptians allow all right, what do you, anybody, so Adrian, you don't agree to that. Okay, well, what's your proof?
Well, in the desert, they sort of complain about how good they had it in Egypt, eating meat and whatnot. So that leads me to infer that they also own property.
There's a more direct proof. What did the Jews leave Egypt with? The Torah says openly.
Their livestock.
Their livestock. Thank you, Marvin. In other words, the Egyptians, interestingly enough, they enslaved them, but they did not confiscate all their property. They obviously did not pay them for their work, but they paid them and they fed them basic rations, okay? And to the extent that the Jews, when they're in Egypt... whether in the desert, romantically, sentimentally go back and say, oh, it was great. We had free fish, and we had melons, and we had cucumbers. It was awesome. And now all we got is this, insignificant bread, the manna. Okay, so...
Was it a socialist regime, or was it a capitalist free market regime?
Well, it was a tyrannical regime, which was, of course,
Did you buy your groceries, or were they divided for you?
They just got rations, right?
Well, it seems that the Jews were given food who were part of the workforce. You know what I'm saying? I don't think they got money, but they clearly had. But they, they came down with livestock. They developed that livestock, and it was never taken away from them. And two, they had homes. They lived in homes, so they weren't given like. It wasn't like in put in concentration camp barracks. I'm not saying that you know, again, let's remember there was a time that the boys were thrown into the Nile. So I don't want to say this was their experience in Egypt was Club Med. It's not true. And clearly they were beaten. You know what I mean? There was violence, and they had all these things, but it was a very, because remember, this goes into a more general point. Paro could not overtly enslave a community that was invited into their country by the previous administration. So he had to do some of this covertly. You know what I'm saying? So therefore he didn't just take all their stuff from them. And you see there, we read, as Marvin read earlier, each woman would ask from her neighbor. So they're living in, they're not living in separate neighborhoods. They're living in, or the Jewish neighborhoods are very close to the non-Jewish neighborhoods. So they're, in other words, the Jews during the Nazi regime had it way worse. The Nazis took away all their property, beat them, made them do slave labor, and for anybody they could, they killed them. That's the worst. It's as far as persecution of the Jews, the Nazis are the absolute worst. That's it. Nobody worse than them. But Paro's so the question is, so why did Hashem ask them to, Scott said, well, they need to start afresh, which is true.
They trade them gold and stuff for food with other villages. It gives them like currency.
Right. And start off with, start off your life with some capital and some resources to start a new life with. Correct. In fact, there's a mitzvah when a person, there's a mitzvah called Hanaka, which is that a person at the end for slavery, letting go of a slave, you don't let him just go. You need to furnish him with a number of stuff, so therefore he can start the person's life successfully. Okay, so that's good. Good answer. But what else? What would be their immediate use of all these the gold and the silver, as we know later on in the story? What was their first destination they were told about they're going to go? They made it. Until the 10th plague, what was Moshe asking them to do? What was Moshe asking? Because people forget. Moshe tells Paro, let my people go, not ending right there, so they shall do what?
Pray to their God.
So they can have a 3-day festival before God. So they're going to have a big holiday, which is going to become Har Sinai. So therefore, what do they need? If you're having a big holiday, what do you need? You need money, but you have to dress nice. If it's Yom Tov, you got it. Nor people don't think about that the Matan Torah, when the Jews were dressed Matan Torah, they were dressed in their best. This was their holiday. They had not had a holiday for over a century. You know what I'm saying? This was a big deal. So they had to dress to celebrate God's revelation to the Jewish people and humanity. Okay, now.
Is that also why, it's a kind of like a custom or like Shabbos, you shower, you shave, take your suit out of the closet, take the plastic off, and.
Yes, it's not just a custom. It's an obligation. There's a mitzvah, a rabbinic mitzvah of kavod Shabbos, of showing honor to Shabbos, that and Yom Tov, to dress your best, make your house come look clean, clean up your house, and then not only that, have 3 wonderful meals. Let's go to question number 6. If another reason that you could have suggested is if the goal was to secure national reparations. What are reparations? Fancy word. What are reparations?
What Germany still sort of pays people.
What are reparations?
In the basic sense, it's damages. You got damage. Someone injures you. and then, you know, they owe you monetary relief if they can restore you. Like in South Africa, they try to, you know, when they ended apartheid, they had a system where they would literally try to put the person back in the way they were before they were abused. But right. If not, at least monetarily, compensate.
Right. So first of all, remember they were slaves. So did they get paid for their labor? No. So therefore, you could argue that they're being paid for back wages. Well, that's called reparations. B, they're leaving and the Jews are going to give them all their real estate. So it could be paying for, and in Europe, my father-in-law receives a check from the Republic of Germany. Because he's a Holocaust survivor. And many other Holocaust survivors, both throughout the world, in America and in Israel, receive reparation checks for the war, either for the property that was taken or for the lost wages, etc. Now, if the goal, and God told Avram, the Jews were going to go into a land not their own, they will be afflicted, and they'll leave Berechush Gadol, with great wealth. Okay, so what's the reason? So if the goal was to secure national reparation for unpaid work, which, by the way, many of the Mefarshim say, many of the commentators say that, why did Moshe require the Jews to personally ask their next-door neighbors versus himself negotiate for reparation to be paid from the state treasury of Egypt to pay them? You know what I'm saying? In other words, reparations, if you're getting reparations, my father does not go knocking on the door of, anti-Semites, former anti-Semites in Hungary and in Germany. You know what I'm saying? It's paid by the republic, by the government. Reparations is a governmental program. Yet Hashem tells Moshe to go to the Jews. Each person should go to their neighbor. Why are they doing that methodology? It's a little strange.
Because the Pharaoh, he's not going to tell his people to give up all their wealth. It's not going to be good for him.
Well, he's telling the Jews they have to leave. You know, after the 10th plague, he wanted those Jews out of there.
Right, he wants them out of there, but...
And Hashem gave the people favor in the sight of Egyptians. So they let them have what they wanted. So if Hashem's creating favor, that Paro should have favor to the Jewish people and grant the Jews from the national treasury, you know, every person gets, you know, X amount of cash. You know what I'm saying? X amount of gold. Everybody gets, I don't know, 50 pieces of gold, whatever it would be, okay?
I think there might be like a lesson there to be learned, which is evil triumphs when good men do nothing.
Okay.
Evil triumphs when good men do nothing. And so maybe that's a lesson that even though these neighbors, they were actively inflicting the Jews, they sort of stood by and didn't do anything. Maybe that's what I'm talking
about. So you're viewing it as a punishment to the neighbors, to Paro's willing collaborators, that they're being punished by them having to pay the price.
By omission. Guilty by omission.
Okay, that's an interesting idea. Why not? All right.
Rabbi, question.
All right, Chaim, go ahead.
Could be a space now, but... Who are you asking? The Medrash is saying it's reparations, or you're just asking them?
Many of the Mefarshim say the reason that the Jews were getting the gold, silver, and clothing was reparations. In other words, payment for either A, like Rashi brings down the position of that they work for free for centuries, for decades.
But is it reparations from the government or from the bad the neighbors were causing them and taking their stuff?
So
who said the government took anything from them? The neighbors.
Well, no, because clearly Paro, as we from the story, Paro is the quarterback here. He's the tyrannical leader who is creating a systematic program of enslaving the Jews, which he successfully does, According to a calculation, the Jews were physically enslaved for about 100 of the 210 years, somewhere around 105, 110 years of actual labor.
Does that say that the neighbors, the actual Egyptians, took advantage of the Jews on a personal level?
There are midrashim that say that as well.
Why wouldn't I just say that that's what this is in reparation for, not on a national level? Hashem dealt with Pyro on a different level by
Mount right. So that's you're following to the Adrian camp, that basically these people were active collaborators. So therefore, as a way to punish them, if you will, they got to go and pay. They got to pay up. Okay, that's good. Hashem took care of Paro by killing all the firstborn of his nation, his firstborn animals, and his gods. So, okay, I think that's a legitimate theory, but I think there are many possibilities here. Anybody have any other ideas? Any other thoughts? All right, we got two good thoughts on the floor. Anybody else? What would be a benefit to have the Jews ask their neighbors for the cash?
Would it help them lose the whole slave mentality or slave identity?
Oh, how so? Good, good, good.
Because if you're asking your neighbor and making that, like, instead of being a national treasury type thing, if you're asking an individual Egyptian to give you reparations or some type of objects, that mentally you'll think that you've moved beyond, gotten out of the slave category.
Excellent idea. That's the idea that Rabbi Mann shared with me, which is that exactly what Sean is saying, is that basically the reason that Hashem told Moshe to tell the Jews, it's not simply to get the gold for them to be compensated, not only for compensation, but also psychological rehabilitation. You have been a victim for your whole life as a slave. Where is your self-esteem? Where is your sense of dignity? Where's your sense of goodness? You've been completely crushed. So Hashem allows the Egyptians to look at the Jews favorably in appealing light, and they give generously to the Jews. So what does that do? What does that make the Jews feel? How does it make them feel?
Like they've been paid back for all their suffering.
Not just paid back for their suffering, it's true. What else? Brooke?
Be empowered to kind of take their own actions and solve their own problems.
Yes, they have been psychologically built up, rebuilt. A sense of dignity. Their former oppressors are now handing them, here, take my Armani suit. You know what? Here's my Rolex watch. You know what? Here's my diamond ring. You know what I'm saying? And the Jews put them on. And then not only that, clothes for their kids. They go from feeling like losers, emotionally devastated, to a sense of dignity, a sense of honor. And they didn't walk out of Egypt like thieves in the night. That's why they left Egypt in the middle of the day. The Torah says, "Biyad Ramah," with an upraised hand. What's Yad Ramah? Like when you see when a football team wins the Super Bowl, how do they walk off the field? Just in an orderly line. They have hands up. They're like, yeah, like victors, like a sense of pride, with a sense of like they're champions. Which, of course, in what sense was Hashem acting as a psychologist giving therapy to the Jews? Let's bring a full circle here to Howard Stern. How is Hashem acting as a psychologist giving therapy to the Jews? Phil, let's take it full circle, Hill. Full circle. Sean, fill it in. How is Hashem functioning as a psychologist?
Well, essentially, like before, they were downtrodden, like having very low self-esteem, and the therapy of asking their neighbors for the clothing, for the gold and the silver, it gives them that higher self-esteem, feeling like a sense of worth in the world, and that's how they could move forward and march to Har Sinai.
Yeah, so Hashem sort of helped the process go. What did he do to help this process be successful? Very important. And I'll scroll up to the pasuk. How does Hashem help this therapeutic?
All right, the Egyptians were already predisposed or already were giving favor to the Israelites, so it wasn't like such a hard ask.
Right, so they asked them, and they didn't get a negative. They didn't get rejected. The Egyptians, for some reason, which is another shear how that happened, looked at the Jews after the entire plagues in a favorable light. So therefore, when they asked, and in fact, Rashi, which Marvin read, not only did they say, you got one? Take two. You got one Rolex watch? Take another one. One bracelet? Take two bracelets. One suit? Take two suits. Okay? So the bottom line is that they were given generously. So basically, that's part of, as Sean pointed out, God was functioning as a psychologist to the Jewish people to start the process of leaving the slave mentality. Now, of course, is the slave mentality, you hand a slave a Rolex watch and an Armani suit, are they now don't have the slave mentality? No, that's not something that you snap out of, okay? But it was an important step, you know what I'm saying? In psychological, if a person has an issue, especially deeply seated issue, they're not. It took years for them to develop that problem. It's going to take some time to work their way out of that problem. But this was step one. They walked out, as Sean beautifully said, with a sense of self-esteem, worth, dignity, and they have a plan. They have a mission. They were given the mitzvos of Korban Pesach with matzah and maror, dressed to leave, and they're starting a brand new life and a life with dignity. And Hashem, you see here, from this perspective, is very concerned about not just their physical well-being, they're not being enslaved, but their psychological well-being. You know what I'm saying? That's very important. And you see it had a big impact because as the Rashi that Marvin read earlier is they had the gold and they had the silver. They had the silver, gold, and garments. What did they cherish the most? Says Rashi, based upon the order of the Pasuk.
Clothing.
The clothing. Even though that the gold, the gold wash is way more important, more costly than the garment. So now we can understand in a deeper way, why was those garments so critical to them?
Clothing is a reflection of your identity.
Yes, I'm now wearing the clothing of the ruling class. I'm wearing the clothing of an aristocrat. I'm taking off my clothing of slavery, and I'm putting on a clothing of a beloved member of an exalted people. And that was a very, very big deal. And it had a big, big impact. All right, now let's check out. Now, interesting Rambam. Let's have somebody. Good, yeah, Chaim. Question. Good.
The Medrash says that they hit it and then they knocked and they said because they knew where it was, they showed them right certain things. Was that just for the gold and silver, or also for fancy clothes?
So you bring up an additional Medrash. I can't do all the Medrashim, but that Medrash indicates that during Makas Choshech that they first scouted out the situation. They knew what to ask for. That implies that the Egyptians on one hand found the Jews appealing and charming, but they also they also liked their stuff, and they weren't so. Overwhelmingly, they had that Medrash indicates that there was some resistance. But once they pointed out, what do you mean? You got? I know you got a watch collection in that drawer over there. So all right. So that Medrash is indicating sort of a story behind the story behind the story. We don't have to go into that level of nuance right now. But still, at the end of the day, the Egyptians still gave it to them, and the Jews felt great. And that's the main thing.
I was just asking how that Rashi, if the Rashi goes with the Medrash, if the clothes were also, like, and the value, as far as the value for the Jews.
I'm not sure if these Midrashic schools of thought are exactly in line or not in 100% in line. They could be a different angle.
You're talking about how Rashi learns it and how he...
Well, Rashi dips into the treasury of Midrashim. He's going to take that Midrash, which he thinks is sort of critical to give you the subtext of the story. But there are a lot of Midrashim. He doesn't take all of them.
I'm just asking if the clothes is part of that, or just the gold and the silver and the jewelry.
I don't know factually. I have to look at that Midrash a little more carefully again. I don't know. I remember the Midrash, but I'd have to read it over carefully to see if that point's made. All right, let's check out this Rambam. Who would like to read? Any volunteers? All right, Scott Shapiro, always volunteering, good man.
Rambam, laws of. Chapter 4:1. Since maintaining a healthy and sound body is among the best ways.
Well, the ways of God.
Best ways of God.
Doesn't say best. You're adding a word there.
Sorry. For one cannot understand or have any knowledge of the Creator. If he is ill, therefore he must avoid that which harms the body and accustom himself to that which is healthful and helps the body become stronger.
Okay, so the Ram here in the Laws of Character in Hilchos Deot tells us that having a healthy and sound body is a Derech Hashem. In other words, a good Jew. This is it. You see it in black and white here. A good Jew's goal is to have a healthy and sound body, not just physically but mentally, because you can't understand. Or every knowledge of the Creator. You can't learn Torah if you're sick. You can't serve Hashem if you're sick. If you're not healthy, you got to be healthy. And therefore, you got to be careful to avoid things that harm your body. And conversely, you have to pursue things that are healthful to your body and helpful. Okay? This is just a very important principle, you know? And by the way, just sort of a social criticism, I don't think Orthodox Jews are so good about this. In other words, chalt is delicious, and I like chalt, you know what I mean, on Shabbos, but the obesity epidemic of America, which is now closing on 70 to 80%, has not, shall we say, passed over the Jewish community. So there's a mitzvah. To work out, it's right here. It's a mitzvah to eat healthfully, right over here. If you psychologically, you got to take care of yourself, physically and psychologically. That's the Derech Hashem, okay? And I'm just saying, and just because there are Jews that don't do this, we don't do the right thing because what our neighbors do. We do what the right thing is, and this may be an area or a mitzvah that these individuals. Struggle with. It's not easy to struggle with being healthy. Very hard. Okay.
I was going to add, Rabbi, yes. Not to take too much time, but there are Orthodox Jews who are becoming like role models in this. I don't know if people know Beatty Deutsch, who's a Israeli marathon runner.
Yes.
Like, there are more and more inspiring stories about people who observe halacha and also prioritize health.
So, Brooke, you are 100% correct. And my role models, which I'm still not emulating as much as I would like to, will be my two Rebbeim, Rabbi Yisrael Shait, who's my Rosh Shiva, who would was initially back in the 80s, was overweight, went to the doctor, he says, you're overweight, you got to lose weight, came back 4 or 5 months later, had lost all the weight, always exercised, worked out, ate exactly the right food, as did Rabbi Mann, who works out 6 days a week. I will give a plug. I'm not a paid endorser. I'm finding a lot of success using the Peloton app. I have a stationary bike at home, and I've been enjoying that sometimes 7 days a week. How do I do 7 days a week? right before Shabbos and right after Shabbos, Friday, Saturday. So I recommend that. The instructors there are good, and you can get a good workout for 30 minutes. And of course, if you want to do more, Harezim Meshubach, and it's not just biking; they got all kinds of stuff. So I think
to plug the Peloton app, but I actually use that too, and I started doing yoga for the first time ever. It's great.
Yeah, they have yoga, they got running, they got weight training, they got everything. So that's part of the mitzvah of having a healthy body. You want to make sure that you're in shape as best you can, eat properly, and that's it. Okay, now let's take it to question number 8. In what way did Hashem's therapy of the Egyptian Jews foreshadow and instruct us in the priority of self-care of the laws of character? How did Hashem's therapy of the Egyptian Jews foreshadow? This is at the beginning of the creation of the Jewish people. This is the first night of the Jewish people, the night of leaving Egypt. How did he foreshadow, instruct us the priority of self-care? What do you say, guys?
Well, this is before the giving of the Torah, right?
Yep.
And so, you know, it seems that your self-image is a precursor to everything else. Basically, how you see yourself, what you're capable of. I think the saying is, if faith is staking your life at a possibility, courage is staking your life at a possibility, faith is believing in that possibility. If you don't even think that it's possible for you to do something, faith won't even, play a role. If you don't even see the possibility. First, you got to, see yourself as worthy of being able to do something.
Exactly. Well said. Hashem had to communicate that he believes in them, that you are worthy, you are valuable, you are significant, and he wanted the Jewish people to have a good sense of self. You cannot receive the Torah and be a good Jew if you feel diminished, if you feel depressed, if you feel deficient. It's a preliminary element. In other words, really, this is part of the preparation for the Jewish people to receive the Torah. Hashem is giving the Torah to healthy people, not ill people. And not only did Hashem help, but we have to, and as we've said probably hundreds of times on this class, we partner with Hashem. So we have to do what we can to ensure that we are healthy, that we are in good shape, both physically and mentally, and that way we can grow as people and as Jews in the best possible way. So at the very moment of us leaving Egypt, Hashem was concerned about our psychological well-being. All right, now we're going to get to the scenario part of the program. Okay, here we go. Scenario number, question 9. Joe MGEer has plenty of friends. If he wants to go to a movie or a restaurant, he has 20 options. He has the pick of parties and Friday night Shabbat meal invitations. Yet when he's struggling with forced loneliness of COVID, he has no one he feels comfortable to speak with. He realizes his relationships are quite superficial. What would Howard Stern say is the opportunity that awaits Joe?
Discover himself.
Okay, want to unpack that a little more? What do you mean?
Well, Howard Stern seemed to say that he didn't really know who he was, what he was about. He had no idea. So instead of always searching outside and just for the superficial, which goes along with the pleasure side of it, trying to understand himself internally and be able to deal with himself and cope with himself and be by himself and not be dissatisfied, just looking for that external distraction from having to be with himself.
Excellent. So Marvin pointed out beautifully, in other words, that Howard Stern had many, many friends, many fans, but as he admitted that until he had a therapeutic experience or a therapeutic intervention, he didn't really, everything's a joke, which is a denial, which is a defense mechanism. And he was really covering up some foundational problems, some traumas and sense of and various destructive behaviors. One of the articles I was reading in preparation for this, that his daughter, who became observant, Emily, says that she doesn't date much. Due to the over-sexualized nature of his father's, you know, show and lifestyle, just she doesn't feel comfortable having a normal relationship with men because, you know, I don't know if you don't know about Howard Stern, you know, you'll Google it. But it was just, you know, ridiculously over the top, you know, coarse and sexualized. And therefore, what he didn't realize, one casualty was his own daughters. Because if every woman is essentially a prostitute and everything is about physical sexual pleasure, therefore, is it a surprise that his daughter is going to have some problems in that area? You know, it's not a, so that's, it's to have a, you know, I picked that case because it's an extreme case, but Joe, who has many friends, but he doesn't have intimate friends. He has friends who he can play ball with and go to movies and have a good time with, but there's nobody he feels comfortable sharing about his life. And that's something that he needs to make a breakthrough with. And Howard Stern might say that, you know, he would say, look, I got a lot of help by going to therapy, and Joe, you might as well. And that's part of self-care and the mitzvah to build a strong body and mind. Let's go to question number 10. Emily MJ here has a friend. Yes.
Can I throw a quick thing that I observed?
Good.
It's not that humor can be a defense mechanism. I think that's difficult to comprehend sometimes. That, like, for example, I find that in my early days of going on dates, before I went on 1,000 of them, I would always be like smiling and like kind of laughing. And I find that girls are actually more interested. The guys that are not jumping from one foot to another, trying to always be uplifting and happy and feel comfortable, sort of being vulnerable and you know, speaking about serious things without any. Yeah, that's just something that took me some time to realize.
I understand that, but I'm being Joe, a person who, right, a person who's joking all the time. There's a place for jokes, and it's, you know, it's great, but sometimes the joking is really a masking, is a distracting. If a person can't be serious at all, there's a problem. And humor is a way to not deal with problems. Okay? In fact, if you listen to a little closely to, you know, quintessential American, and they'll admit it, like Bill Burr, who, you know, who's on, you know, Conan O'Brien. You know, his monologues is just like, you know, a psychological train wreck. I mean, it's funny because we're not him, but he is a person who has, he's got a couple of least cases of baggage over there. And he'll admit it, you know what I'm saying? So, in other words, it's a defense mechanism, and if you're really good at it, it could also be entertaining to others, but it does not remove the fact that it's still a tool of distraction and denial, as mentioned earlier. All right, 10. Emily MGR has a friend named Miriam who is painfully shy and is afraid to ask to be invited over. What does the principle of loving your friend as yourself inform Emily what to do? What should Emily do?
Invite her when she has his room.
Okay, so but if it's not, what else? Yes, and post COVID. Post COVID.
And like introduce her to like other friends.
Yes.
Like that, like buffer. You know what I mean?
Yes. Or speak to another friend. Hey, Stacy, why don't you? Could you
meet
do
Miriam?
Call up Miriam and invite her. I know you're having a big Friday night. That would be great. She's a little shy. You know what I mean? In other words, if a person is, you know, a person has a problem, you can be helpful by helping her, by being the therapeutic guide.
Build her up.
By building her up and pulling her out. Otherwise, she's going to be, you know, stuck as a hermit in her apartment and she's never going to come out. So a good friend will try to, and not do it in an embarrassing way. You know, I know you're a big fat loser and nobody's inviting you. No, you know, you go to your friends to buy, and they call her up, and therefore she feels like $1 million. You know what I'm saying? You do it with v'hadrechamocha, loving your friend as yourself, is doing it in a way that you're concerned, is an obligation that you're concerned about the emotional well-being of a fellow Jew. So if Miriam is painfully shy, you have an obligation to try to work around that and try to get her included so she's not alone. Last case. KDMG here has an older parent who refused to go to the doctor and to investigate a suspicious symptom. What are Katie's obligations to intervene and be successful with getting the parent to go to the doctor? What's the obligation?
I'm not sure that this answers that quite, but you want to say, hey, mom or dad or whatever, I would like to go with you. I want to take you to the doctor, and this way we can be there together. So if there is something there's, you know, that is found by the doctor, they have somebody to support them and say, I'll be there, I'll stand by you. So
That's a great strategy, but what is the obligation of the child to do that?
Honoring the mother and father.
There you go. Kibbutz Av Em. Basic Kibbutz Av Em is the basic level of kavod, is ensuring that all the basic needs of your parent is taken care of.
Rabbi, question?
Chaim, hopefully.
Right. So in this scenario, like if you're dealing with mental health and a parent,
yep,
can help and you have to intervene, is it better for the person to disrespect the parent in a way the parent gets angry and is angry and may ruin the relationship, but at least the child is getting the parent the help that they need and gets to the doctor and hopefully the parent gets healthy because of it?
So if you're dealing with a person in that case where Katie, if the mom is refusing or the parent is refusing, so you might want to yourself go to an expert in dealing with this problem. This problem is extremely common. I spoke to...
can you trick the parent, right? You trick the parent, you say, we're going out for dinner, and then the next thing you know, they're at the doctor. Like, V.A. Baracus got it. They got him in the A-team. They always got him on the plane.
So I don't want to answer. I'm not qualified to answer that question because obviously they'll get very angry. I don't, you know, you can't. In order, you can't. You know, strap a parent down to the examination table for them to go to the doctor. You gotta work with them. And there are. I was speaking to a social worker because I was providing counsel to an adult whose parent trying to get the parent to be involved in various activities and, you know, to deal with a problem with a stubborn, you know, elderly parent. And that's an art to deal with that. That's not so, by the way, that's an art to deal with that. And this particular social worker who deals with, you know, geriatrics had like 10 ideas that I would have never thought about of how to work with a specific problem. So if you have such a problem and you're tapped out and your strategies are not working, Kibbutz Av Em demands that you got to go to get expert opinion to figure out how to do it, how to get the job done. Okay. And by the way, you know, for those people on the phone, you know, on the call here that have elderly parents, this is a real issue. This is not a theoretical problem. You're all going to face this. Okay? Some parents will be compliant about all things. Some will be compliant about some things. Some will be stubborn about all things. Stubborn will be stubborn about and you got to deal with that. And this is, in other words, the old question, when is it harder to do the mitzvah of honoring your parents? When you're a teenager or when they're elderly? Not so simple. When you're a teenager, you know, you think they're a bunch of idiots and they're restricting you and they're just being insane, and you can't find the ability to have any kind of reverence for them and treat them in any kind of honorable fashion. That's challenge when you're an emerging adolescent and young adult. Then when you're older and they're elderly, the obligation to take care of their needs is very complicated. I'm dealing with a situation, very simple. I'll give you the most simplest case. As you know, in the state of New York, right now it is January 19th, so about 2 weeks ago, people above 75 years old were entitled to get the corona vaccine. Now, what's part of the problem is that it has this online sign-up. So I was dealing with many families that, you know, their 77-year-old person is not, shall we say, super slick on the online, you know, filling things in. So you have to get online and put their information and sign up for the, you know, and find a time, you know, a place to go. And you got to do it for them. You know what I mean? Many, for you to, you know, to be on the internet is something that you're on the internet, like, you know, literally every waking moment. But for people who are in their 70s and 80s, email and text, it's a source of bafflement for them.
Well, the New York State site has been also a disaster from what everything I've heard in the news and from people who've tried to use it. So that only complicates it.
Right. I did it. Well, so Marvin, I did do it for an elderly person. It did take me. It was not terrible. It wasn't so intuitive. I'll grant that. But I did sign the person up in about 120 seconds. Okay. But if they had to do it, they'd still be working on it. Because it would have been bad. All kinds of bad. They would have not gotten an appointment, okay? Especially when you have, you know, the limited supply right now, and you got to there's a slot. You snooze, you lose. So you got to intervene. You're not gonna let a person who asked you, like, one second, the email came to my phone. Is it also on the laptop? You know, when they're getting these kind of questions, you know, they're trying to work the interweb, and things get on their phone and they're not sure if it's a text or an email. They're still struggling to figure that out. I don't know where it came from. These are real things. I'm getting some nods from the people in the audience here. You know what I'm talking about. So it's only going to get worse, okay? So that's it. That's the basic deal. You have to have concern about your self-care, and you have to be concerned about the care and well-being of your parents. It's a basic obligation in the Ten Commandments. Kabed avicha vet imecha, honor your parents, and basically take care of them. They need they got to get an appointment. You got to sign them up. They have a hard time getting there. You got to drive them. That's it. It's not complicated. It's not fun. It's not what you want to do, but it's something which is critical. And certainly the more difficult things, like, you know, going to a psychologist, to a psychiatrist, and getting care where a person is resistant, or, as we mentioned before, fear and shame and denial and all these things, it's not so simple. But this is where the rubber meets the thing. And I think the beautiful, inspirational point is that Hashem wanted the Jewish people, well, they walked out of Egypt, to walk out there standing tall, wearing their new clothing of aristocracy, of distinction. Hashem wanted them to feel special, wanted them to feel good. And that's our obligation for ourselves and for every Jew. And that's something to think about. Any questions?
All right. I have the same question now the other way with Vafter Kamoch on a friend. Even if you might lose the friendship, but they may listen to your advice and get that mental help.
Correct.
They only may thank you later, but do I look at the obligation of Vafter Kamoch that that person, like, tell them the truth, and that's why they have this happening to them? Because they're so
Well, as you know, there's an art to an intervention. Okay? You just can't stop.
The idea that there's, right, I wouldn't give somebody rebuke or give them the insight unless I thought they would get, right? But once they heard it, maybe that light bulb would click. They may be angry with me till they get healthy. But it might take 5 years.
But
I put that aside. And
yes, yes. If you feel the goal is to get the job done. If you feel a person suffering with an addiction, suffering with a mental illness, suffering with a physical illness, and they're not getting the care they need, and you have the level of influence, they'll listen to you, or they might listen to you and another people, and you can sort of do a, you know, what they call an intervention. Okay, I'm not saying how to do that.
That's a strategy.
That's a strategy in its own self, and I'm not equipped to do step one on that. I'm admitting that right now. But let's say you're going to do that, and they're going to get the help they need, but they're going to be personally angry at you. That you got to do it, because you have the obligation for their well-being. You're going to lose their warmth, friendship. You have to do it for them. That's a real friend.
I did it recently with somebody, and I basically made myself the bad cop, but I had one of our other mutual friends be the good cop. It sort of shifted as a bad cop, and it worked.
But good. If they get the care they need, they will admit, they will come back and they will thank you, Chaim. They will come back and thank you because you did the right thing, and you had the courage to do the right thing, and that's very important. And most people do not. People do not like to rock the boat. And you got to have courage. You got to be courageous. These are, you know, people think of courage in the battlefields. There's courage in the home. There's courage with your friends. There's courage with your family and your relatives. And that's real. And I'm not saying do stupid things. Do it with an intelligent, thoughtful way and get expert help. But you got to do it because you need to help people. You got to be there for people. Even if they don't see it.
I knew the person wasn't eating. I said, you have to eat. The person didn't listen to me. But then I realized, you know what? I called so-and-so. I said, why don't you go invite that person over for pizza or for a barbecue? And that's how they went
beautiful,
over.
Beautiful, right. There's a lot of applications to this. You know, let some of these conversations marinate. These things are all over our lives. Very close to all of us. All right, guys. I want to wish you all the very best. And next week, we have a special... return visit of Rabbi Bernie Fox from Seattle. Will be giving shiur. And he's coming back. He liked you guys, and I heard good. And you guys liked him, so let's we'll go for a second round.
Is he doing parsha? Is he doing b'shalach?
I don't know. I don't know what he's doing. I don't know what the sheer topic is. I'll find out. Well, I'll let you guys know. All right, guys, have a great night.
Putting on the
soul. Thanks, Rabbi.
Good night. Thanks, Rabbi.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Rabbi.